on 3rd August 78 at IRSI in Helsinki. Now, can you tell me just what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
I lived in Cambridge. That was my hometown.
I see.
So I was actually born in Southampton in England. And my father was Australian. And when I graduated in Cambridge, my first degree was a BA, which is what everyone gets, mm-hmm. even if you're a scientist.
Right.
And in 1954. And I applied for a research studentship from the CSIRO because I wanted to travel and see the world, and mm-hmm. the possibility of working in Australia was very attractive,
sure.
particularly with my family connections. And so I got this studentship and then looked at the various kinds of work that were going on in Australia at the time. And I had a talk with Pawsey, mm-hmm. who was visiting England for a conference that summer.
Oh, I see.
And there was no doubt that the ionospheric work was the thing that would interest me most if I was staying in Cambridge, but that the most interesting and exciting thing at the time in Australia was the radio astronomy work in Sydney. And
well, why was it that the radio astronomy work in Cambridge didn't look appealing?
It was not that it was not appealing, but I had had some contact with Mr. Ratcliffe, who mm-hmm. was the ionospheric group there, and I was attracted to working with him.
I see.
And therefore, the not doing radio astronomy at Cambridge was it was because I had a stronger positive reason for doing ionospheric
okay.
research, because I wanted to work with Ratcliffe. And if I was going to Australia, I wanted to work with Pawsey. As things turned out, I did both. I got this studentship, mm-hmm. Which was for to spend about 2 years in Australia, and but I arranged to do a Cambridge PhD, and this was possible under certain conditions, because I had the intention of returning to England and doing a PhD at Cambridge. And so the way I did things was a result of personal background and inclinations.
Right. I see.
And I first spent a few months in Cambridge because first as a more or less as a vacation job, and then it continued for a few months to get some background in the ionosphere. And so I did, just for a few months in 1954, work in the ionospheric group in Cambridge, and this gave me a background which turned out to be very useful when I went to Australia. And I had some contacts with the radio astronomy group then, mm-hmm. and in fact I had attended Ryle's lectures and mm-hmm. in Cambridge, so I knew something about what the group was doing.
Right.
But my desire to go to Australia, I mean, then took me to Sydney. And then I was attached to the group that was working on the Mills Cross and the low-frequency cross of that Shane was building.
Right.
So that the people that I worked most with were Bernie Mills and Alec Little and Alec Shane mm-hmm. and Kevin Sheridan as well, who are here. And I always been grateful for this background that I've had in working with such a fine group of people. It was a great experience, I think, and I've always looked back on those days. I hope not in any sort of nostalgic sense, but I mean, it really was a very fine experience working there,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't just that group. It happened that although I never did any solar work, I had quite a lot of contact with the solar group, because any newcomer to the lab at that time was put in the charge of Steve Smert, and whose job it was to show him all around the different parts of the lab and make sure he saw the whole picture of what was going on before his work became specialized into in a particular group. And with this brought me into contact with Paul Wilde and Jim Roberts, and drinking sessions in the pub across the road after work with Paul and Steve.
Now, I didn't quite understand the Steve Smert thing. He's a theorist, of course.
He's a theorist, and of course I have some theoretical background too. My more subsequent work in the ionosphere has all been theoretical. I mean, I've never been much of an experimentalist,
mm-hmm.
No, it was just that he was the person that always seemed to get this particular job of looking after a scientist on arrival, where whatever the scientist was actually going to do.
Now, so, which years were you actually in Sydney?
55 and 56. Okay. And I left about March 57. So I was actually in Sydney and arrived in February 1955 and left about March 1957.
And at that time they were building
They had finished the 85 megahertz cross, the Mills cross, and I helped operate it in the sense that I helped just the routine running of switching and swinging the beam.
So the survey was in progress.
The survey was in progress, and I helped to run it and adjust as an assistant.
Right.
Then I also helped Alex Shane and Little in the setting up of the 90.6 megahertz cross. And the Pawsey thought that the general work that I should do was just an investigation of galactic H2 regions at the two frequencies. And that, in fact, was my main work.
So that was really mainly his suggestion?
That was his suggestion. And he put me onto that work, and I don't think I ever did very much with it, but I did write a couple of papers, one on Orion and one on the Vela Puppis region.
Right, in the Kepler supernova remnant.
Now, yes, well then, these two things were, the Gemini and Kepler papers were a byproduct, really, and quite an interesting one. It just so happened that it came to the attention that there were going to be lunar occultations of these sources.
Right.
And there was a paper published by the Czech man.
Oh, yes, I know who you mean.
Well, I've forgotten.
Yes. Link.
Link, that's right. Link and Nerzil, or Nerzil, published this paper, which actually, we found it later, it contained a few errors, but I managed to put these right and to calculate the details.
This was about the lunar occultation method.
It was about the lunar occultation method. I just calculated the particular circumstances at, of the occultations as viewed from Sydney. And as luck would have it, there was an occultation of IC443, mm-hmm. which is the Gemini source,
right.
Observable when the source was at transit, and this was a good opportunity. And as you know, the Mills Cross was a transit instrument,
right,
and
right.
we observed it, and that was 1955, October 8, I think. But I think it was
to be exact.
It was engraved on my memory,
yeah.
And the observation was a success. And what it showed was that although only about 20% of the visible nebula was actually obscured by the moon, because the nebula is nearly a degree across, that a much larger proportion of the radio flux mm-hmm. was occulted. And this, and since it was the brighter optical part of the nebula that was occulted, that this suggested that the radio emission was associated with the optical
right.
brightness. And this, although perhaps fairly obvious in a way, right. was a result that was worth establishing at
well,
the time.
Well, at that time, the H2 regions known. And so forth,
yes.
And so, you're operating at 80 megahertz.
That's right.
Rather low frequency.
Sure. So, I mean, this, so I did some rough calculations from using very simple considerations as to what the source looked like mm-hmm. at RF, bearing in mind that the beamwidth was very similar to the size of the source,
right.
so that one couldn't get a very detailed picture of it. So, the Kepler supernova was not a very successful observation, and it required swinging the beam off in the east-west direction because it occurred off transit. It could be done by altering the phasings in the east-west
right.
arm of the cross, which of course was not normally done. It was just done for that special
right.
occasion, and the resulting paper was marginal. But the Gemini one, which
yeah.
was my first one I published, is one that I still think was a reasonable piece of work, though, as I think generally happens with one's first paper,
yes.
that you go into too much unnecessary detail.
And right.
Lots of it had. Well, the group there were very good at sort of getting me to write it up and trying to restrain me from putting too much unnecessary detail
into it. Yes, I've heard about the internal refereeing.
Yes, well, that was a very good thing. And yeah. Most of the labs that I've worked in have had internal refereeing systems, and I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. And it was very beneficial. I mean, it's beneficial to you even when you become a senior worker, when you start, it's essential.
Did you happen to know about the paper by the Get Manseth and Ginsburg in the early 50s on the occultation method?
No, I don't think I did.
I don't think this was generally known in the West, but...
I don't.
Okay.
Lincoln Noisel paper. There was an observation done at Cambridge, which a few months before, because they had some occultations
of the crab?
Yes.
It was in June.
That's true.
There were several years where people in Cambridge and the Russians also were trying it.
It's rather interesting to flash forward a few years, and that just in the very recently I've been concerned with a rather way-out suggestion concerning the lunar occultations of the Scorpius X-ray source. The point about this is not the astronomical implication, which is well known, and it's a way of studying them, but some people have suggested, on rather shaky evidence, that the Scorpius X-ray source has some effect on the ionosphere at night.
The only way to turn it off is to put the moon in front?
Yes, and this in fact is possible. It doesn't happen very often, but it will happen a few times in the next few years. And so I've been suggesting to some of the ionospheric groups, it happens that these are all in the southern hemisphere from the actual geometry of the things. Mm-hmm. They might look at it, but again, it's a rather marginal thing, because I think most ionospheric physicists don't believe that this is an important effect. Hmm. It's part of a general rule that I've, in the course of studying the effect of eclipses and on the ionosphere, that I think that eclipses and occultations are quite good astronomical tools, mm-hmm. but not very good ionospheric ones. Anyway, that's a diversion, but it might be of interest.
Yes. Now, as an outsider, I would be interested in your comments about radiophysics as you saw it in those 2 years. What really made it go, would you say? What was the reason that it was so successful?
It was successful because it had a lot of very good people who had their own drive and to generate self-propelled research groups and mm-hmm. the technical competence to build up large instruments, and there were a number of these people: Mills, Shane,
Christensen,
Wild, and one or two others. You see, but those were the giants in the subject.
Yeah.
You see, and they were all people that I got on with very well. Although, I mean, in the course of the work, I had more to do with some than with others, just because I was attached to a certain line of
work. Do you think that this mode of having these various small little research groups at different field sites was a part of it? In other words, were there structural things that helped?
Well, I think it was inevitable. I think that was the way that the subject had to proceed at that time. That only changed when you built up one very large facility, as the Parks, which was after my time. And then it became necessary to put a large part of the resources into that one project.
A more general purpose.
But radio astronomy in the mid-50s was at the stage where the individual instruments could be built and looked after by teams of that sort of size. And I think that's why it worked.
2 to 4 people.
Yes.
Or something, yeah.
And I suppose perhaps a bit more than that. 5 or 6 people on average, but of course the actual staffing would depend on the particular level of effort needed at the time of that phase. And one thing I did not get was any feeling of isolation from the outside world.
I mean,
because people have said about Australian science that it's very isolated. Mm. Now, I don't think that's true. It certainly wasn't true in radio physics in those days. The reason it wasn't true is that the people were internationally minded, and they did get opportunities to travel widely. But some people, not so many, but some, did come to Australia because it was such a strong place.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the ERSI meeting there in 52, which must have been a big fillip.
Yes,
though I wasn't there.
Yeah, many people have told me that was really of course, quite an honor to have it there, and also it was the first time I got to meet all of these names that they'd been reading about on papers.
Yes, well, I mean, by the time I went there, I mean, that immediate effect of warming up.
Yeah, that phase.
But, I mean, I think there was no doubt that the group had arrived on the world scene. So, I mean, I don't feel that I did anything spectacular as regards physics in my subsequent work. I mean, I think what I did was what I hope was a competent job of gathering up the data that that were obtainable with those instruments on those particular H2 regions, but I never made any striking discovery with them.
So then I guess you went back to Cambridge and wrote it up or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. But there was one other interesting thing that happened during the time, and that was the Jupiter business. And this was very exciting. The discovery that the decametric radiation from Jupiter was Burke and Franklin.
Right,
and,
55.
Yes, and I was there when in the lab when Shane realized that these observations could have been made with his 80.